Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider. One of the great things about interviewing people for this podcast is that you learn the weirdest things. For example, I learned that my next guest, Charlie Friedman, comes from a Canadian family who made their money by stamping dinosaur nuggets out of frozen chickens. How could you not grow up to be wildly creative with a background like that? Charlie trained as a corporate lawyer but moved into food and wine and then into wine writing. Today, however, he's most famous as the president and co-founder of Proxies, one of the earliest brands in the non-alcoholic drinks space. Now, I have to confess, I haven't tried Proxies myself because they're not available in my market, but I've been hearing about them for more than 2 years. People who I truly respect who have tried them are really enthusiastic about them, saying that they are the closest that anyone has got to making a truly satisfying wine substitute, but one that stacks up as a drink in its own right. And Proxies are not de-alcoholized wine, but as you'll hear, something else entirely. This is a great story about innovation, and as always, the takeaways will be in the newsletter, which you can sign up to at drinksinsider.com. Charlie, thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, you've got a very diverse professional background. Where did you start and how did you end up making Proxies?
It's quite a journey. I mean, as you said, I've worked as a lawyer. I started an apparel company with a friend of mine, doing athletic apparel, selling that direct to consumer. I've worked as a food and wine writer. I've had a few other failed food businesses.
Let's go right back to the beginning. Tell us about the apparel. Are you still making it, or did that fall by the wayside?
No, that fell by the wayside. Maybe I'll start even further back, actually,
yeah,
if that's okay. It really starts, I grew up in the food industry. So my father and my uncles and my grandfather had a frozen chicken business. And so if you've ever eaten a dinosaur-shaped chicken nugget, our family, we like to say, was the first ones to make those.
How do you make a dinosaur chicken nugget? Is that like a whole factory full of like cookie cutters that come down and make dinosaurs?
You know, I was pretty young, to be honest, but it was through my whole childhood. Yeah, I mean, it's just it's a mold that shapes it. But yeah, we made all kinds of products. And it was that type of thing where, you know, I grew up going to grocery stores and to Costco, and we would stop in front of the freezer case that had, you know, our family's products, and we'd talk about them like we were strangers to the product. We'd go in the shelf and make sure stuff was merchandised well, move it, you know, so it was front facing.
So you're like authors who go into a bookshop and make sure their book is facing outwards. That
exactly,
kind of thing.
Exactly like that. And so, you know, I never worked in the business. It was sold to private equity before I was sort of working age, but definitely immersed in that sort of culture of CPG and food business and understanding it. A bit, at least, how that works, and how the dynamics of that business are. So this was sort of always in the background. And then, you know, I went to law school. I don't know why, but I went to law school, and I ended up working as a corporate lawyer in New York for a few years. It was
what sort of corporate law?
A mix of stuff, mostly securities law. Like IPOs and stock offerings. And it was right after the collapse of the economy in 2008. And so it was an interesting time to be working. It was like, sometimes it was actually quite slow, which is not a thing you hear about New York law firms that much. But then it was crazy busy as well.
Was everybody depressed in the wake of that? Or was everybody like, ooh, there's lots of bargains around? Like, what was the mood like in corporate law at that point?
Everyone was quite depressed. I'd say, like, we started with, you know, when I was in law school, we had a class of like summers, we call it, like students who come work for the summer, intern basically. And there were, I think, about 50 of us in the summer. And then 50 started that year, and very quickly half of us were laid off. I was not, but it was that type of time where a lot of people were being laid off. You know, there's a million law firms in New York. So especially in that time of the economy, you know, the partners had a hard time saying no to any clients. So if something came in Friday at 7 p.m. and it needed to be done by Monday, you know, you were there all weekend. You were there till 4 a.m. You were doing the whole New York law thing, but it was more irregular maybe than usual. Sorry. But it was, yeah, I made some great friends there and I got a lot of great experience and learned a lot, but it was a place where, you know, morale was not super high, if we're being honest. And so I think that was a lot of, I didn't feel fulfilled by it. And, you know, I was in a place where I thought I could, and I wanted to try something new. The upside of those jobs is they do pay really well. So, you know, I was able to save a little money. And then I ended up meeting someone who was running a sort of upstart restaurant consulting firm. Now, I'm not sure that should be a thing, but I joined him and sort of helped with some of the legal work, some business development. And in the end, you know, we ended up opening a restaurant on the Lower East Side in New York. And, you know, law training didn't really matter at that point. I was cleaning toilets and washing dishes.
And was that fulfilling? Was that more fulfilling than being in a Manhattan office?
You know what it was? At the same time, I was also, there was a place called City Winery in New York that was bringing in grapes from you know, California and from New York as well, from the New York vineyards. And we were making wine in the city. And so I was just working for free, waking up early and like working harvest there around that same time. And that was also much more fulfilling, not getting paid, you know, being inside a tank with a bunch of grapes and that sort of thing. So it was an interesting time for sure in my life. I'm sure my parents, who, you know, paid for part of law school, were questioning what was going on. But I did feel better about it, even though it was crazy. But in the end, you know, restaurants and New York, like it was a bit of madness. And so I ended up moving back to Canada. And yeah, eventually that's where the athletic apparel one came in. So
you're in grapes in an urban winery, and then you're in athletic apparel. What links those two life decisions?
Nothing, honestly.
Absolutely nothing.
Absolutely nothing. I think a bit of entrepreneurial spirit, but to be honest, that was, I had come back to Canada. I had a friend from high school who had this sort of half idea of like, which is crazy because we did okay, but now it's like, you know, if you look at like Vuori and some of these brands that are similar to the concept we were doing, it was like, can we do an unbranded sort of dry fit type athletic shirt, make it in Canada, make it sort of, you know, with better materials and locally, and frankly, sell it at a better price. And we did that direct to consumer. So on Shopify, it was, you know, it's funny because it's come back and been really useful for me. It was my introduction to this sort of world of online selling, learning a bit about sort of, you know, some consumer marketing online. I mean, different world then, but learning the Shopify ecosystem. So it was a fun thing we did for a bit. But ultimately, I always wanted to get to food and drink.
Do you get led astray by your friends? So, you know, you go into wine with a friend and you go into athlete.
I think not typically, but I am... I guess, I don't know. I've never had that put to me like that. It's interesting. I think curious, but I always wanted to get back to food and drink, and that's always been a passion. And so, yeah.
Okay. So tell me how you got into the writing about it.
Yeah, it was a period where, you know, none of my food business ideas had been taking off that well. And then I saw a food writing class, which is not normally a thing I would be the type of person to do, but the teacher was someone I had heard of and respected. And, you know, he's a cookbook author and a food journalist who I knew. And so I took the class, and he had an assignment early on that was, you know, write a fake pitch email, basically, you know, for a story. And so I did. And he said, well, you should pitch that for real. And it was about, it became actually a series of stories, but it was about sort of the natural wine boom in restaurants in Canada. And I said, well, okay, well, can you give me your editor's contacts at the Globe and Mail, like, you know, the national newspaper in Canada? And he said, no, that would be cheating. Like, you find it, which I respect. So I did. And yeah, it ended up being two or three stories in the Globe and Mail. And I, you know, it was just a few years that I spent really starting to get into that. I think I had I'm not going to say I was the best writer in the world, because I wasn't, but I had a bit of a unique perspective where, you know, I really had, first of all, I had a bit more life experience than some of the younger writers, but I had that food and drink knowledge from having done some of this stuff for real, and from really, you know, knowing and understanding people who work in the industry. I had a curiosity about people, and sort of really wanted to tell stories that were a little different and frankly, like, bring a little personality of my own to it. So a bit of humor and a bit of, you know, knowledge mixed together. Now, like, some stories are silly in your writing listicles, but some were better than others, for
sure.
That's
right. So what typically happens when you get into a major newspaper like that is suddenly people take notice of you. Did that open doors for you?
Yeah, a little bit. I was never the type to, like, be like, yes, I'm saying yes to all these press, you know, press tours or gifts or things like that. But definitely, you know, you started to make some more connections in the industry. Started to, you know, it's harder when you're not in New York, to be honest, like, all the writers were in New York, but to meet some of these people, at least online, you know, Twitter, before it was sort of a hellhole, you know, had sort of some relationships with other food writers and editors. And so I was able to then write for, you know, for Food and Wine and Wine Enthusiast and places
so
like that.
What period was this? What year was this?
This was sort of right, the couple of years right before the pandemic. And so I felt like I had just sort of started to hit a stride, as you say, where people were, you know, reaching out more. And I, you know, I was doing some travel writing. I had started to do a bit of sort of, I don't know if I'd call it restaurant criticism, but a guy named Chris Nuttall-Smith, who was a big food reviewer in Canada. We don't really have any food critics anymore, restaurant critics here. It's sort of a strange situation, but he had launched a website of his own, sort of a model like The Athletic, if you're familiar with that, but for food writing. And he had come to me and was like, can you come write with me? Which was really cool, because it was a new thing I hadn't done, sort of restaurant criticism before. You know, and I had started to do a bit more travel journalism, but then, you know, the pandemic happened and suddenly there weren't restaurants, there wasn't travel. A lot of media was frankly struggling for money. So as a freelance writer, that was really difficult.
Was that the only thing you were doing, or were you still involved in restaurants at that stage?
You know, I was always playing with other entrepreneurial ideas, but it was the main thing I was doing. And so that was, you know, I was lucky to have my wife has a great steady job. And so I'm not going to say that I was, like, you know, really the breadwinner at that time, for sure. But that was
okay,
what I was
so
doing.
We got to the pandemic and the world shuts down. What happened next?
Oh, okay. This is a complicated one. So my older cousin, who again also grew up in the same family in the food business, he's a serial entrepreneur. And we had always talked about doing a business together. And he has a million ideas all the time, some of which I like, some of which I don't. And so he came to me and he said, I met these two food scientists from the University of Guelph outside Toronto, and we're going to start a fermentation, a vinegar company, a condiment company based on vinegar and fermentation. And that's going to be called Acid League. And I said, okay, you know, that one's actually kind of interesting to me. It was at a time
it's
when...
It's actually a great idea, especially at that time. It was a fantastic idea.
Yeah, the Noma Fermentation book was sort of just coming out and was becoming in the zeitgeist. And I think, you know, if you looked at the vinegar aisle, you know, you had balsamic, you had apple cider vinegar, you had red wine vinegar, and that's about it. White wine vinegar, I guess. Sherry, but so I keep naming more. But there was no, like, innovation in terms of flavor, branding, anything like that. So the idea was, let's start with vinegar. Let's bring a modern take to this with real ingredients and a real process and real credibility behind it. And at the time, you know, this was just an idea, basically. And they said, Charlie, like, do you want to join and help with the marketing and help with sort of the seeding into the chef community, since I had just been working, you know, in food writing and had some of these relationships? Can you help us there? And I said, okay, you know, that's interesting.
Let me just jump in. So how big was this conceived at the start? Was this a kitchen table enterprise, or was this, let's go and get ourselves a commercial kitchen, let's go and get ourselves storage? How big was it?
Yeah, I'd say it was somewhere in between, right? This is where the shift comes. It wasn't meant to be like farmer's market brand, but it wasn't meant to be like immediate grocery store. Mm. But what happened was, you know, they got a meeting with Whole Foods National in Austin and sold 3 SKUs in right away across the whole country.
Hang on. How do you get a meeting with Whole Foods? That doesn't just happen. How did that come about?
Look, that wasn't me. I'll be honest. Scott, my cousin, he's very persistent, and he's had a lot of successful businesses, and so he was able to work some connections and get an intro to a buyer, and it was just right place, right time. The buyer was seeing this trend, was interested in a company that could work alongside them, to be honest, like could, mm-hmm. you know, had the food scientists. We were making all the products ourselves. And so it wasn't like a co-packer situation. We could be nimble. If Whole Foods said, hey, we'd love to test, you know, this type of sauce, we could make that and make it pretty quickly. And so it was a symbiotic relationship where Whole Foods was almost a testing ground, a lab for Acid League. And obviously for Acid League, you know, you were launching a business in a much bigger way than expected. So that really shifted what my potential role became in the business.
Okay, so first of all, let me just slow you down there. So what were the three SKUs you put into Whole Foods? What were the first ones?
There was a strawberry rosé vinegar. There was a mm-hmm. Meyer lemon honey vinegar and a vinegar that was called Garden Heat, which had tomato, carrot, and jalapeno. And so it had all those ingredients fermented into vinegar, essentially. That one ended up being the worst seller, but was by far my favorite. It was really cool. It was almost like half hot sauce.
When you get opportunities like that, sometimes they can have a hidden danger, which is that when you go big, all of a sudden you have to find a way to fund it. How did you fund that rapid scaling up to, you know, be able to submit things to Whole Foods?
You're right. And dealing with, you know, the distributors, in this case, UNFI, and learning how to work in those arenas, I think came with a lot of growing pains. The funding, I think, initially was sort of self-funded. You know, like I said, my cousin has had some businesses exit before, had friends and family, and so we raised some money privately, but quite quickly brought on a couple of venture investors, Canadian funds, and so, yeah.
Okay, hang on a second. Now, that's another thing that doesn't just happen. How did you bring on board some venture investors? Did you have your pitch deck and you went and you said, we've got vinegars? What happened?
Yeah, I don't want to overstate. I was not a founder of that business particularly. I was one of the first like employees technically, but there were early pitch decks. There was a strong team involved, and we, you know, our main investor, which is still the main investor in Proxies today, because Proxies grew out of this company Acid League, which is where we're going. You know, we did split out the two companies, but is a firm called Investico, who's based in Toronto as well, and funds some really great, you know, innovative food brands.
Okay, so which came first, the order from Whole Foods or the venture capital?
The order from Whole Foods.
Okay, so at that point it becomes easier. You go, we've got proof of concept, yeah, we've got the sales. Okay, all right, so I cut you off. The story continues. So now you're supplying vinegars to Whole Foods. What happens next?
So I came on, so like I said, originally the proffer was, can you come help us seed this with the chef community? Suddenly you have, you know, this need to put this into Whole Foods. And there was, we had a designer on board who was one of the co-founders, but we needed to make labels, we needed to write product copy, we needed to create a website, and that's where I came in, really, was...
Yeah, let's get the food and wine writing guy, let's get him to do the copy.
Yeah, and I, you know, there was a lot I had to learn. I hadn't really written product copy before, but I think that was part of the appeal, right? There was a bit of a different lens to it. You know, our labels looked a bit different than what was on the shelf. They spoke to you a bit differently. We'd talk about pairings on there because we cared about food, but there would be like sort of vibe pairings as well. Mm-hmm. You know, so it was, that was a really fun time. We were building out an e-com business at the same time, which, like I said, I had some experience with. We were growing the team, you know, this was...
Was this still in the pandemic? Were you doing all of this?
Yes, maybe just a bit before, like these times overlap a bit.
Yeah, sure.
But yeah, it was during the pandemic and early pandemic, and you know, it was before people realized what the pandemic would be. So venture money was still available, and you know, businesses were still in sort of growth mode, and so it was a fun time. You know, really growing our product line, and learning a lot. And at some point there in 2021, or actually 2020, end of 2020, we had this sort of idea that didn't quite fit in Acid League, but, you know, we had a friend, who had been working as a winemaker in Australia and in New Zealand, and he was home in Canada because there was a pandemic. We had this idea like, look, like non-alc wine is just such a tired category too, like even worse than vinegar was originally. You know, the branding was really terrible to us. We're a team of wine lovers. You know, I still drink wine, not as much as I used to, but I still do. De-alkalizing wine was sort of always a less than proposition. You'd lose a lot of the body. And anyway.
I'll say it. Well, you don't have to say it. I've tasted so many of these, and they're still a work in progress, put it that way.
You lose a lot of the character, you lose the body, you lose the, you know, all everything that makes wine special, and you're left with this odd yeastiness that's in all of them, no matter how good a wine you start with. And the truth is, you know, there's four or five places in the world that actually do this de-alkalizing. And so it's expensive. So you're not really using the best wine most of the time anyway. You're using some bulk wine. You're then stripping out what makes that even wine. And frankly, like, you're shipping stuff all over the place. It's not environmentally sound either. It's just a bit of a... Anyway, it's not a process that spoke to us. It's not a product that spoke to us. Friends of mine who were in the restaurant industry, you know, they knew they wanted something, but they didn't see anything that looked like the wines they were serving, that tasted like something they'd want to serve. And so we said, can we do something better? That was just the figment of the idea that has become Proxy.
So you've actually hit on two really significant trends just as they were starting to take off, the fermentation and then the non-alc. That's really interesting. Is that from you were noticing that, or you're around people who've got a kind of spooky ability to look at the future?
Yeah, I think... The whole team at Acid League we were all like food obsessed, drinks obsessed people. So right. Scott, my cousin, as I said, he worked in innovation consulting prior and worked for a lot of large food companies, you know, Diageo, Kellogg's, all the big guys, Unilever. So at a time when they all had innovation budgets and didn't know what to do. So he was really at the forefront of that for a long time. And then had started some other food companies as well, but also is just the type of person who's just consumes food media constantly. I was in food media, and then Cole and Alan, the food scientists who started Acid League as well, are, you know, it's not always true that food scientists love food, but in this case, they were ones who did. And Devin, you know, the winemaker I was speaking about, is also like obviously loves wine and drinks, but is obsessed with tea and food as well. And so we just all were sort of tied into this culture and understand what's going on, I think, a little better than most. And then frankly, you know, like I said, we had also this close relationship with Whole Foods where the buyer was sort of using us as a testing ground as well, and vice versa. And so we had this direct link to what Whole Foods was seeing in trends and what they were looking for. And, you know, they were looking for a beverage as well. And we said, I don't know if this fits in Whole Foods right now, but it still was a figment of an idea that helped.
I just want to go back a step. So you've introduced the vinegars to Whole Foods, but although vinegar has been around for a really, really, really long time, in effect what you did was create a new category. And new categories can be very difficult to get off the ground. How did Whole Foods introduce it to consumers and promote it?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I think, you know, these are new types of vinegars, and it was, you know, every recipe says use your balsamic vinegar, use your red wine vinegar. And so it is hard to introduce something new. And I think if we're being honest, we could have done a better job at that. So I think that's something we took as a learning in proxies.
Well, tell me about that. What would you do differently now if you were launching vinegars?
I might start with other products, to be honest. I think in terms of vinegar, I think there's a way to go. But so something like Garden Heat that I said was my favorite, I don't think it was helpful to call it Garden Heat, which was sort of esoteric and people didn't understand. I think like if it was tomato jalapeno, people would understand that. And those are like flavors they get. So there are some things like that, small things.
That's a really
I think we would have done a little more with sort of the nice thing about a product like that versus proxies is there is a world, I think it's taken off more since we launched. So this is a bit, you know, hindsight 2020, but the sort of like cooking influencers, you know, social media aspect, you see a company like Graza selling olive oil has done a really good job of like being in everyone's kitchen that's on Instagram or TikTok cooking. And so I think we would have leaned in a bit more to that. Anyway, I'm not directly involved in Acid League anymore. You know, I'm very busy with proxies, but yeah, that's, I think.
So let's move on to proxies. So how did you start with, how were they developed?
Yeah. So like I said, we had this idea of like de-alkalized wine doesn't work. Can we do something else? Can we make something that fits the wine occasion? Can we try to create a beverage that, you know, what we think makes wine special is its ability to pair with food, is that it has body, it has tannin, it has a balance of acidity and fruit, and that it has complexity. And so can we try to create something in that realm, whether it tastes like wine or not? That was the initial. And also, you know, I get a little frustrated sometimes. What does taste like wine mean? There are so many varieties of wine, right? And so many different sort of ways that people make wine, something that you understand as, you know, bulk California cab. Sure. I understand what people mean when they say that tastes like wine to me, but there's lots of wine that tastes completely different. So anyway, our idea was to do that. And so we said right away, like, what are beverages that are most similar in structure to wine? And tea came up as something that we thought, you know, has a tannic structure, has some body, and tea became a really important part of our blend. So we started to play around with, can we mix, you know, teas and fruits and frankly, like, you know, grapes, grape juices, wine grape juices, verjus, so unripe wine grape juice, and different spices and aromatics. So in some ways, you know, when you see a wine writer like I've been at times, and you know, you've done, you know, these wine tasting notes that to some people sound crazy, because really there's just grapes in wine. In some sense, we were putting those actual things in the bottle, right? And so we made a couple first sort of blends. We put them in wine glasses. We swirled them around as if it was wine. And we said, like, you know, I think we're onto something. This was late summer, fall. And we said, can we get this out for dry January? Like, dry January is becoming a thing. Like, we can see that.
Was this completely intuitive based on your own knowledge? Or did the flavor scientist come along and say, look, you've got to construct this like a perfume. It's got to have a base and it's got to have this. You've got to have this. Like, how much of it was that kind of knowledge versus your food knowledge?
No, yeah. Like, we never went to like a flavor house and said, like, can you help us make something? I mean, we probably would have shortcutted a lot of mistakes in some ways. But no, it was quite intuitive. It was more like people who know how to cook and know how to like what things taste like. So it's almost like a chef sort of process of, you know, adding ingredients, seasoning them. So like there's some salt, for instance, there's, you know, some acid, and seeing how that balance comes out, and then trying to edit like any good recipe. You know, can we pull some things back to make a little more clarity of flavor? So it was quite intuitive, but what I'll say is, you know, we launched in January of 2021. We got it out. It was, you know, pandemic was pretty strong then. So there were no restaurants open really in Canada, at least. And we said, okay, let's launch as an online, not wine club. And, you know, this is not wine. It's not de-alkalized wine. Let's see what happens. So we said, we're going to make 3 new proxies every month and send them to you direct to your door. That's a crazy proposition, by the way. Nobody should do that. Like, we were here making something that basically no one else in the world had made anything like this. And we said, oh, we're going to make 3 new ones every month.
Okay, I just want to go back a step here as well. Okay, so you've got your recipes and stuff. How did you bottle them? What happened next? Because what you do in your test kitchen and then turning it into a commercial product, how did you do that?
Yeah, so we had a small production facility, you know, at Acid League. And so this was under Acid League at the time. And so we had, you know, some equipment and we had all the certifications and so on. And we brought in, you know, a small filler and a hand corker. And we did it all ourselves at the beginning. We did everything ourselves. We waxed the bottles at the time. We learned how to wax. Some of the early attempts were super thick and really crazy looking. You know, there was one that we had as a joke for a long time that, it looked like a beret, and we kept that bottle around forever. But like, you know, we were sort of doing everything ourselves. You know, like I said, we had food scientists on the team and we had a winemaker on the team and we had people who knew what they were doing. So there was definitely like, it wasn't like we were putting out products that were unsafe at all, but we were making them ourselves, so we had a lot of flexibility.
Yeah, and three new ones a month. So you must have been in the kitchen around the clock. So was this something that was totally sold through DTC, or were you also making this for Whole Foods? Like, how did you launch it?
Yeah, no, it wasn't at Whole Foods, and we thought this needed a totally different approach. So we launched DTC only at first. And right away we saw, you know, the timing was good. Obviously it was dry January, but...
How did you get people's attention? Like, how did people know that it was out there?
Well, we had an e-com platform already from Acid League that had been running a bit. And obviously they had a bit of, you know, the company had a bit of recognition being in Whole Foods nationally. And then, you know, we had a PR firm at the time that put this out, but it was a bit organic, honestly. Like, we put this out and we said, here's something new. We did a bit of PR, tried to send some samples to people. And again, the timing was good and it was a novel idea. But what happened was, you know, right away we saw, hey, this is a new approach. you know, were interested. And so, like, for instance, you know, we always wanted to be more in the restaurant community. We thought we needed to bring credibility, not just to our brand, but frankly, to the whole category. This one, you know, like you said about vinegar, but like this was really an entirely new category. And so we always knew we wanted to work sort of almost traditional alcohol style, you know, when restaurants existed on premise out, built credibility. And Sean Brock, a famous American chef, we had seen that he had just recently gone sober. And he had previously been known for drinking way too much bourbon with Anthony Bourdain. So that was interesting to us. And we said, like, okay, like, can we sort of play into this chef community? A lot of people in the industry are drinking less. So, you know, many are even going sober, even like Psalms often now. So can we reach him? And by the time we did, like, I had PR trying to reach Sean Brock specifically. He said, you know, he wrote me back and he said, hey, like, we ended up just DMing him on Instagram, to be honest, was where he finally responded. And he said, guys, like, I'm a subscriber. How'd you miss that? You know, like, I'd love to, can we do something together? And that's like, we hadn't really considered it that deeply. And we said, yeah, we'll do something with you. And so, you know, we got on a call with him. He ended up taking out all our like marketing materials. We like send tasting notes in all the e-com boxes and he pulled them all out. He's like, I love these things. This is so cool. Like, I want to make one. So we went down to Nashville and we played in his kitchen and we used all kinds of new ingredients. And that was our first collaboration.
So the moral of the story here is keep checking your email lists.
Pretty much. I mean, it's don't be afraid to reach out to people. I think, like, you know, we've done probably 7 collaborations now, and you know, they've been Sean Brock, Dominique Crenn, 3 Michelin star chef, like the, you know, really big chef in the US, Andre Mack, who's probably the biggest wine personality in the US. We've done some other, you know, Michelin-starred chefs in Chicago, winemakers at Division Wine, and so on. And none of these were paid. They're all totally organic. They're all people who just wanted to make something new with us. And, like, at the time, Dominique Crenn was on Iron Chef on Netflix. Like, she was doing movies and TV, and, you know, I skipped ahead a bit here, but like we started to sell through some, once the world opened up, through smaller wine distributors to sort of seed the product in high-end restaurants, in credibility driving stores, you know, wine shops and cool food stores. And we brought it to Atelier Crenn and we were told, oh, like, no, thank you. Like, we'll just make our own non-alcoholic stuff. I said, okay, like, please just taste anyway. We'd love your feedback. And then, you know, we said, and by the way, like, you don't make your own wine, so just think about it. And they did. And you know, the Somme got it to Dominique and Dominique tasted. And she said, yeah, we have to put these on the menu, but also I want to talk to these guys. So, you know, that was just what happened. We at the time we were getting pitched by these talent agencies like, oh, do you want to work with this chef and this celebrity? And you have to give them X shares in your company and pay them, you know, thousands of dollars. And we said, like, no, you know, we're actually doing this ourselves and just coming across it organically. So it was super cool and super rewarding. And honestly, like, I think really kept us going.
There's the other question of category. So you've created a new category and sometimes that can be a real problem because people don't know where to stock you. You know, do you put them in the wine aisle? Do you put them in the soft drinks aisle? Did you have any of those sorts of problems? How did you say to the market, this is how you should feature us?
Yeah, I mean, we're still having those sorts of problems. I think that's, I think the UK is further ahead than Canada and the US. And even there, this is still an issue. I think the strength of our business having started D2C is, you know, we have a lot of data. So a few things there. One, we've made, you know, we stopped making three a month at some point. Then we were making six a quarter for a bit. We've really stopped. We still make some limited editions, but less and less. And, you know, in some ways it was confusing the market, but it was really amazing product development experience for us, but research as well, right? So we got direct feedback on all these blends, and we could push the boundaries of like, what can non-alc wine be? And sometimes we went too far.
Okay, so tell me, you got to tell me which one absolutely tanked. Which one did you think, this is fantastic?
I mean, we made like a Madeira style sort of dessert type thing once, okay. That was crazy. You know, when you're putting out three a month, also sometimes, you know, like it doesn't go exactly as planned when you scale up for production. So sometimes things would get too smoky and yeah.
Which was the one that you put it out and the market just went, yes, this is the bomb?
You know, I think early on there was, we've sort of shifted a bit what we do. So like early on there were a couple. There was one that was called originally Terre Sauvage and then Sauvage, which was us sort of saying like, it doesn't have to be wine. Here's our Canadian terroir. Like here's our history. And so it had wine grapes at the base, but it also had some sort of crisp green apple. It had some spruce tips, which like, you know, locally foraged in Canada. And so it was this really, it was a mission statement in a way, and became one of our first, you know, core wholesale SKUs that we made, you know, over and over in the first year or two. So that was one that I'd say it's polarizing for sure, because it, you know, it had strong flavors, but there were people who really loved that. The other, also another white, that we did in a sort of, Gewürztraminer style that has had a couple names. The first time it was called Tripping in Alsace. We had crazier names at the time, and then it became Pastiche. Anyway, it had, you know, stone fruit character and some clove and just, you know, not sweet, but at the time they were, you know, if we're being honest, there was a bit more sweetness in the products back then. But a really high balance, you know, a lot of acidity too, like the pH super low.
So let me ask you, what you're describing is you're describing very artisanal, thought through products, but there comes a point where if you want to scale up, it becomes harder to source ingredients. So how do you maintain the artisanal approach without becoming industrial? Is there a limit to what you can produce?
I mean, I think where we are today is a bit different, right? We do still make all our own liquid. We don't bottle it ourselves, so we send it to a local place to be bottled, but we make all the liquid. And we've changed our, you know, we've gone through, like I said, all this feedback that we were getting, and what we landed on was a bit of a more wine-like approach. You know, we believe, especially you were asking this question, in sort of trying to build the category now at retail, and that's sort of just coming for us, to be honest. We've been really patient about that. We wanted to build up credibility. We wanted to build up experience. We wanted to get our product right. So the last year, we've actually been refining our portfolio a lot and have just launched some new products. There's, you know, a new product that we're launching next week. By the time this comes out, it'll be out, a new white, a still white. We have a new sparkling.
What's it called? Use this to advertise it. What's it called?
This no crazy name. So the new red is called Big Red. The white is just called Proxy's White. And it's just like, it's funny because it harkens back a bit to what I was talking about with this. It's not like a Gewürztraminer, but there are some, there is a bit more, there is a lychee character to it and stone fruit, but sort of also this sort of crisp, almost, you know, Sauvignon Blanc drinker can get behind this vibe. And it really came out of me. We've been searching for an idea for a new white for a long time. And I pulled a random bottle out at my parents' house, and it was a Muscofolero that someone must have brought to them as a gift. And so not like, you know, a well-known varietal. But I read the notes on the back of the bottle, and it said notes of lychee, ginger, like spicy ginger, and a bit of a floral character. And I said, you know, like these are flavors we can make. These are flavors we can do. And then I tasted it and it was delicious. And I said, like, can we, so I brought that in, you know, to the facility and sat with the team.
Do you know what's so funny about that is wine writers constantly talk about how all these flavor descriptors are useless and meaningless. And what you've just said is I built the whole product out of these flavor descriptors. That's hilarious.
I mean, it shifted a bit over time, but like, yeah. So anyway, we have this new white, which I really love. It's crisp, but it's got that sort of those floral aromatics that come out of the glass as well. It's got a bit of more bitterness on the finish than what we've done before, because if you drink wine in a way where you're being, you know, critical about wine and not just drinking with food, you realize how bitter the finish really is, right? Like it's and you also realize that that's that alcohol spice that people talk about is not really the same as like a capsaicin spice. It's maybe like actually closer to a ginger sort of burn and heat. And so that's that we've leaned into a bit of ginger and a bit of, and there's a bit of cooling sensation as well that I think is really nice and refreshing in this. But anyway, I wasn't avoiding the question of the scaling up. You know, like I think there are some ingredients that we use still that are super artisanal. We use really amazing teas. We're brewing them ourselves sometimes. You know, sometimes that's a hot infusion like you would make tea at home. Sometimes, you know, there's cold brew elements. There's a lot of whole spices and botanicals that we bring in that we prepare ourselves. And then, you know, work into the blend. But there are, and there's verjus is at the base of almost all our products, which we source locally to us in Niagara, and so it's produced to our specs, and we have that made every year at harvest, and so, or before harvest, I guess, because it's verjus. But you know, there are now like some more commercial products as well. Inevitably, you know, like a fruit concentrate, for example. In the early days, there were times when we were, you know, cold pressing fresh produce. And that's not only not sustainable, but it's, you know, first of all, like, you don't know what's on that. It's not as safe food safety wise. It's not, and replicable. Like you can't have consistency that way. It's a lot harder.
How many SKUs do you have at the moment? Or how many products, I should say?
It's complicated because at the moment, like I said, we're in this period of transition where we have our sort of old core is still around, which was 4 still bottles. And so we have those. I think future looking, we're going to have 1 or 2 sparkling bottles, the white, and then the white and the red still. We'll probably think of it as a craft beer portfolio. We'll probably bring back a rosé seasonally, and some other things seasonally as limited editions or seasonal variants. And then we have what's really been a big move for us now is we have our 3 cans as well. So everything's RTD technically, but people like to call them RTDs. So single serve, 250 ml cans. Those are all sparkling. There's a white, a rosé, and a red. And you know, for us, we were reluctant to do that for a while, to be honest, because you know the wine bottle is doing a lot of work for us, right? Like it's not wine, it's not de-alkalized wine. We have it in a wine bottle that's signaling a lot of the occasion. On the other hand, you asked about building a new category. What we heard from our consumers and from retailers is people want a smaller option to try. People still like, yes, proxies, you have Sean Brock and you have Dominique Crenn and you have Andre Mack, but people still don't trust, right? Like, and they don't trust the category. And I get that because I don't either. And so they want a single serve option. They want an easier entry point. And so we said, okay, like, and frankly, retailers know how to stock.
And have you found that, did that take off?
Yeah, it's early for us, but that's been the retail growth point because retailers know how to stock, a 4-pack of cans. Retailers don't always know where to put a wine bottle.
That's interesting. Okay, am I right that you've also launched a non-alc red?
Yeah, so like I said, I mean, we've always had reds. Red is the hardest. It's the hardest thing in non-alc. Red wine is just like, if you're de-alkalizing, it's by far the hardest thing. It's always going to be thin. It's always going to be odd tasting and not have anything. So we've made 100 blends. We've made probably 50 of those have been reds along the way with varying levels of success. So, you're never going to make anything in the red wine category that has 100% approval. And that's not what we're trying to do. We're trying to find something that enough people really love, right? Like polarizing is fine, but there need to be the people at the top who really love it.
Let me just clarify. So what I read was non-alc red. So is that a de-alcoholized red or de-alcoholized red that you're adding things to? Or is it just somebody wrote that and it's still a proxy? It's still one of your blends?
No, it's still made the same as our other products. So it's still one of our blends. Okay. So but I think maybe, so this is a funny distinction that I don't want to take up all our time on, but there's this category that often gets called proxies, which is our brand name, sometimes wine alternatives. And sometimes people, this is very niche non-alc sector, lump this together and put it sort of to the side of non-alc wine, like that they're two different categories. And I get it because the products that are often put into the category called proxies sometimes are fancy kombuchas and are, things like the brand Non from Australia, which I'm not saying anything bad about them. They were started around the same time as us, maybe even a little before. And in some ways take a similar approach of this culinary approach to building a beverage for the wine occasion. And I really like their beverages, some of them, but it's a different thing than what we're doing. Theirs are not really trying to be understood as wine, whereas we've moved now more towards, I think at a more mass level, the consumer ultimately, sure, some will care if the grapes came from X vineyard, but like it doesn't matter how it's made. We make non-alc wine this way because we think it's the best way to make a product for the wine occasion. I think it's non-alc wine. I think it fits in the non-alc wine category.
All right. I wanted to be really clear that we weren't talking about de-alcoholized wine. Okay, so when did Proxies become its own company and spin off from Acid League?
It'll be 2 years January. It was consumer facing. It was a little more than that. We sort of split the websites in August of that year. So 2022, is that right? I can't. Yeah.
Okay. And another thing in this category. So one of the things that I've tried loads of sort of spirit analogs, and a lot of them don't last very long, which is a problem for consumers who pay the same as they do for a bottle of gin, and then it's only got a short shelf life. How do you explain what you're doing to consumers? Well, first of all, I'm assuming that yours doesn't have the shelf life of a wine, so correct me if I'm wrong. But if it doesn't, how do you explain this to consumers, or do you just imagine that they're drinking it pretty quickly after buying it?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, when we started, we had 6 months shelf life because we were just testing, like we didn't know, right? We're up to 18 months. We'll probably keep pushing that further because we, just yesterday I tasted something that was 3 years old and it was totally fine, but it really depends on which blend. They're not meant to be aged like wine. There is a bit of, it's not always the easiest. A lot of, most products have.
All right, can I ask you,
it's just not wine.
Let's talk about the numbers.
Yeah.
No. So how much do you produce? How many outlets? What sort of, how big are you?
I always forget these case numbers. We're still a majority D2C business. And we've been patient on wholesale, like I said. So, you know, you were saying, how do you build a new category? And I think it's not quite there. So we sell a lot though, online especially, and we work with about 15 wine distributors across North America in different states 15? And provinces.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's a weird network. And then we're also starting to work with some sort of food distributors as well. And so we probably produce about, you know, I'd say it's like a 20,000, 25,000 cases equivalent. And it's growing a lot, right? Like we're just starting to do larger retail and put, we've done places like Erewhon and Foxtrot and Thrive Market, but you know, we're in Sprouts right now with two of the cans. We'll be in Whole Foods in California in January with two of the cans as well. And you know, some of the bottles are going into some California grocery, you know, regional chains as well as in New York. In New York, we have a bottle at Fresh Direct. And so some of these larger retailers are coming online as well. But it's really, like you said, we're sort of learning from some of our experiences and taking our time with it, making sure that that things are merchandised well, that there is signage that says non-alc. Otherwise, you know, there's no point really if it's just going to sit on a bottom shelf that says specialty and it's like next to a bottle of sake. Like nobody's going to know what it is and nobody's going to buy it. So there's a lot of work to be done in the store and then on our end as well, you know, to continue to grow our brand awareness and really drive people to the stores.
So since you started to now, the non-alcoholic or the substitute space has absolutely exploded. Let me think. If you were starting it today, where do you think the opportunities are now that there are so many more entrants to the market?
Yeah, I think wine is still a bit different than some of the other non-alc categories. There are a lot of entrants, but I think, you know, you need to really understand the consumer and understand flavor and your product and not just that you like it, but like actually test that in the world. You know, like the new red that you were talking about, for instance, like this can look just like a marketing stunt, but it was actually more a product development test. We took it to a wine bar in Chicago recently and we told people, hey, we're tasting three new red wines. Like, do you want to taste blind? And we had them, you know, sit on video and taste these three wines. They didn't know one was non-alc, which I think is a really big, really interesting thing to do because there's this presumption of like low quality to non-alc wine, which I understand as we've discussed. And there's a presumption of like quality to wine, right? And so we said there's three red wines. And we had people drink them. So it was our Big Red. It was, we put Prisoner, in there cause I don't know, I find it funny. And, and we had a natural leading Alianico that the wine bar was actually pouring by the glass at the time. So we had that in there. So it, you know, natural, but quite clean and delicious. And really, you know, we had eight couples taste this or groups of two people. And it wasn't everyone's favorite, but more people picked the Proxy's Big Red as their favorite than any other bottle in that lineup. And
did anybody pick the Prisoner?
You know, there was one person who really liked the classic wine vibes, but like the point being like, and you know, I'm not gonna lie. Obviously there were some people who were like, what's, you know, this tastes a bit, you know, like what's happening here? Like, but nobody was like, this is juice or this is non-alc or anything like that. Right. Like they were really approaching it like wine, you know, they were swirling the glass and sniffing and trying to pick out notes and they were all trying to be wine experts. And, you know, they're like, oh, maybe this is like a Zin and maybe this is a Syrah and like, you know, playing at wine experts. And it was really interesting to us and really you know, we've since gone and tweaked the next batch of that product in response to that and other feedback as well, but always trying to, you know, improve the products and I think really stand up to actual wine if you just give us the chance to do that. And that's really important to us, because ultimately, you know, if consumers come to the non-alc category and they buy something that they don't like, and you and I have both tasted a lot of things that are quite bad, and if we're being honest, like, we put out so many different things in the past, like, we put out some stuff that's bad, so I understand some people from the early days of proxies, like, luckily we weren't so big at the time, but there are some people who had, like, experiences that they'd rather not have had. But, like, we're always pushing to improve, and we're always, you know, trying to lift up other brands in the space that we think are doing good things, and trying to be next to them in retail sets, and trying to grow the category together. And that doesn't mean every brand, because I think there are some that are really cynical plays that taste terrible. And so I would say, like, I don't think those have a long lifespan in this industry. You might make some sales.
It is an exciting category. So, final question, where to next?
Yeah, I think, you know, we're obviously going to continue to sell online at drinkproxies.com, but it is growing more into retail, right? So, and continuing to partner, you know, we're not moving away from the smaller restaurants and from on-premise, but building partnerships with bigger restaurant groups, especially with the cans, bringing that to sort of fast casual type restaurants, and to retail. And so, you know, hopefully expanding this listing at Sprouts right now, hopefully expanding the Whole Foods test market and other retailers like that, your local, you know, as well as in the on-trade retail, right? So, you know, bigger beverage chains, places like Binny's in the Midwest, and, you know, hopefully Total and BevMo and all the sort of local alcohol sellers, where you are seeing this category grow. And for us, it's important to continue to be a leader in the space, both for leading on product quality and leading on sort of thought leadership of what non-alc wine can be. Does it have to be de-alc wine? Can it be, you know, this sort of different type of beverage that we're proposing, and why? And really, you know, getting in front of more people and continuing to build the category alongside some other great brands, some of which you've spoken to. So I've listened to some of those podcasts. Yeah.
Well, on that very positive note, I'd say very best of luck. I can't wait to taste them. I've heard about them since 2022. I've been told about them by so many people, but I haven't yet had a chance to taste them. But thank you very much for your time, and I look forward to the day when I can pour some.
Thanks so much.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome.